Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Pam, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Morgan Asset Management conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer period. If you would like to pose a question during this time, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. It is now my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Jim Kelso, Portfolio Manager. Sir, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Operator. Thank you all for joining me this afternoon. It has been a rough couple of months here with the funds, and we want to take a chance to take this opportunity to sort of get give you some update on what's going on. And not that I can explain all of this by any means, but I certainly will try to tell you what I see. First of all, we do have a very peculiar market in the credit space. And certainly all of you are aware that, broadly speaking, the stock market looks fine. Interest rates haven't changed a great deal, although they're up considerably from March. If you look at March, you find a low point in interest rates, and then they've moved up a good bit. But still, the credit markets is where the real story resides, and it sort of began in the subprime space and then moved from subprime into other areas. Certainly now CDOs and CLOs and anything that is in the structured finance region is now in a real credit vacuum, if you will. Now, I believe that the stocks that we, you know, with regard to our closed-end funds are simply, from an operational standpoint, we have some pressure on our NAV. We have assets in the funds that have been priced down, but we have been able to continue our earnings, and in, five of the 6 months this year, we've earned more than the dividend that we've paid, I think, so far this year. So the earnings are actually better this year than they were at this time last year, whenever we were forced to cut the dividend by a penny. I think last November was on the heels of a very slow earnings or a low earning period in the summer of 2006 when spreads were so tight. Now with this market giving us this much volatility in credits, the actual earnings have improved in the funds. However, I believe the funds are under pressure, or it is my assertion or my belief that the fund's affiliation with and our use of structured finance product has caused them to be viewed in a negative light, considering what's going on in the subprime market, in the CDO market, in the CLO market, and any other structured finance type of instrument. So with that being the case, although we do see a lot of trading volatility and lower market valuations on assets, we have not seen a particularly elevated elevated defaults or elevated delinquencies or lack of payment in our securities other than what we have experienced in the past. It is these are high income funds, and we're dealing with securities that are typically further down the credit spectrum and do experience some difficulty. I remember a year and a half ago or so, this was occurring in the automotive sector, especially surrounding General Motors. So the markets do tend to get quite volatile whenever there's some fear involved. There is a fundamental, I believe, reason that some bonds should be lower, particularly in the subprime and mortgage-backed space. But what we have now is probably just what I see is an extreme overreaction, and really a situation in the broker-dealer market, especially the wirehouse dealers that are so exposed to the ABX index that their ability to value and make markets is severely hampered. So with that in mind, I think that's what sort of follows over to our closed-end funds and our exposure to and our involvement in that market. And there's just a tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater in this case. I guess speaking to the fundamentals, we like the portfolios. We don't certainly. I would like to have less of some things than we have, but we're not experiencing any change in our cash flows. In fact, those are looking good. I as I mentioned earlier, we are earning the dividend. We expect to continue to pay the 14 cents. That's what we're targeting, and to my knowledge, we should be able to continue to do that. We do have some some equity exposure that has helped us a great deal. And up until the recent last 4 to 6 weeks, our corporate exposure had been really very sturdy and had held up very well. But even that has come under some pressure as the credit markets widened out across the curve. So I don't have any specific points to tell you this is exactly why this stock is down or this stock is up. I do believe that RMH, RSF, RMA, and RHY are all being grouped together with any fund that is involved in mortgage-related securities and is under pressure. So that's really what I know. What I also know is that the earnings look good. I anticipate paying 14 cents a share on the dividend, and that is our number one objective, and we are currently on task to do that. I will try to take a few minutes of questions here. I know that we've got a lot of participants here, so it could go for a while, but I will try to deal with questions because I know that many of you have them, and I'll just try to allow the most time here for the Q&A session. So, operator, if you would, we'll just start trying to field some questions right here.
Thank you, sir. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to pose a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Thank you, operator. If you have a question, please let me know. I will try to see if I can get to the answer and what we can sort out. We'll talk about be glad to talk about what we have in subprime, in corporates, or in CDOs or CLOs. Try to line out those items for you.
Okay, your first question is coming from Ian Fitch. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Clearly, the market seems to be discounting many of the RMK funds much more so than some of its peers. And do you attribute that to the fact that your portfolios are that significantly different or that much more heavily weighted in some of these particular types of securities that have come under so much pressure in terms of the subprime types of vehicles, or is it just because everybody is just seeing anything that is associated with RMK and kind of lumping them all together?
Well, I can't comment for sure on that in terms of the other funds that may be used as a comparison and what is in the portfolios, because I don't know what other portfolios may have. But I do know that we probably do have more of the structured finance exposure than a typical high yield fund would be, and that's on purpose, and that was part of our strategy from the very beginning, and it has been a good strategy, and it has worked for us in the past. And this particular time, we're sort of caught in the downdraft here. I also will say that a good bit of the price volatility here is related to the premium, I believe, that was so prevalent in these funds for a long time. I mean, a closed-end bond fund, it's just rare that they trade at premium to net asset value, much less a 15% to 30% premium that we had, you know, last year.
Of course, ironically, now you're at a discount, are you not?
I think we probably are, or getting close anyway. I don't know what the exact NAVs on all the funds are right now, just looking at the screen. But yeah, we may be. It is much more typical, and those of you who are familiar with closed-end funds and trading on that they trade at near or even usually below net asset value. It's much more common to trade below net asset value than above net asset value. So with that in mind, I think a good deal of the market volatility is simply the flushing out of that premium because we've lost all that momentum. Now, certainly operationally, we haven't changed anything. We're doing the same things we've been doing. We're sticking with the same strategies, the value orientation, trying to find the assets that will produce income going forward. And we expect the dividend to stay in line here. So with regard to comparing it to other funds, I think part of it is, you know, the first 15 to 30% of that's got to be the premium coming out of it. And then beyond that, I think it's really a pile on from its affiliation with the asset class.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Lee Davis.
Jim, how are you?
Well, I've been better.
I can believe that. My question really is about, I guess, the net asset value of the funds. Not really. I understand you can't control whether a fund trades at a premium or a discount. So it's really as much about the open-end fund, but the same with the closed-end fund from a net asset value perspective. I think they're probably down in the neighborhood of 10% from the beginning of the year. And just trying to get a handle, you talked about maybe trying to outline maybe the percentages of the fund. I mean, subprime, I guess I equate with housing, and I don't know about CDO and CLO. I mean, maybe you could elaborate some on, you know, broad categories. I'm not sure, again, CDO and CLO, what that exactly means, but I mean, you know, how much is in housing, and has that been the biggest thing that's impacted the fund and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's right, Lee. It is. It sort of starts with the subprime and the subprime loans into housing, but by and large, the players in subprime are also the players in CDOs, which is collateralized debt obligations, which could include anything from mortgage-backed securities to corporate bonds to corporate loans to securitized equipment leases, what have you. It's a very broad category, but what you do have is you have the players, that is the market participants are oftentimes the same or a lot of overlap anyway from subprime to the CLO to the CDO, et cetera. So whenever you really get a lot of pressure in that one area, I believe it has carried over. And really sort of the tipping point, I believe, was the liquidation of the Bear Stearns funds began to just really sort of tip everything over. I also believe that a lot of participants other than bond market participants in shorting or buying protection in the ABX, which is the index following the subprime housing loans, a lot of people, a lot of other funds, macro funds, equity funds, et cetera, expressing a short position in those has exacerbated the downside volatility beyond what you know would normally have occurred, I think, in a bond market. Simply the same as in 1999, bond funds buying stocks because it was just clearly the, you know, I remember someone saying to me, you know, why would anyone buy a bond? It's an inferior asset in the late 90s. So it's kind of now the best volatility to play now is the downside of the ABX. So we have a lot of excess, I think, or additional funds in that particular sector. So it is exacerbating that. And I think that what happens is you find you sort of have the tipping point in the subprime, which spreads to prime. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, those spreads widening so much also carries over now into corporate bonds. The loan index now, which had been over par, into June even, now is below par, and it's down, I think, 4 or 5% in the last 3 weeks. So it is a real credit a sell-off. I mean, I don't know how else to sell it, but anything related to credit is under pressure.
How much of the portfolio is in, then, I guess, what you would lump together in structured finance?
Well, I think one thing I'll have to go back and say is the entire portfolio is exposed, you know, is a credit play to some degree. Okay, it's a high yield fund, a high income fund.
Right.
So, you know, not to say that we've got what we do have that spread into various categories. And as a matter of fact, it looks like that we have somewhere between, depending on the fund, between 15% and 20% exposed to subprime. And then it looks like in CLOs, which is loan, collateralized loan obligations, which are corporate, that's a corporate exposure, but it's in a structured format, CLO, that would be another roughly 15% of the portfolio. And then there are, and then there's another, looks like another 10 to 12% in what we would call mixed asset class CDOs. which could be equipment leases, it could be mortgage-backed securities, it could be medical equipment leases, it could be any number of things. So it's just a different pool altogether. So roughly 55% or so of the portfolio is in some sort of structured product, whether that be a CDO, CLO, mortgage-backed security, what have you. And that may go back to the first question that was asked, is that may be, that probably is a good assumption, is that these funds may be under more pressure because of our use of that particular product.
You know, things tend to go to, when things go up, more to the upside than you think, and down, more to the downside than you would think. And I'm sure that you sort of indicated you think that's what's happening here. Any idea what it takes to begin to see the bottoming process here?
Well, Lee, I wish I knew. Again, these sort of market cycles do take they usually do take longer than you expect in terms of sort of figuring out where they all shake out. The quick answer is I don't know. I do have some speculative answers or some speculative thoughts on that I'm sort of watching because I believe that market technicals have gone so far in one direction. I believe that they're prone to bounce back in the other direction at some point. And I will tell you that the ABX index is not nearly as deep nor as liquid as it would appear, although there's lots of volume that does cross there. My thinking is sometime toward the end of the third quarter and into the fourth quarter, September, October timeframe, a lot of the funds who have been, or a lot of the participants who have been short the ABX will start wanting to cover that. And so my thinking is that may produce a move back in the other direction. There is an incentive to sort of get the year put to bed and collect the fees. That we do see that happen on a regular basis as the year comes to a close. So if I had to just sort of pick something, and again, I'm just guessing and it's just for conversation purposes, but, we're way beyond the actual credit story here. We're really into a technical trade at this point, and we've got all the dealers sort of tipped over on one side, and something coming back the other way I think would move it pretty quickly. I just don't know what that will be nor when that will occur.
Jim, thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Leonard Sewell. Please go ahead.
Hey, Jim.
Hello.
Two questions. First, the funds seem to be below net asset value, which triggers something that has never happened in the history, and that is open market purchases for dividend reinvestment. Do you control that, or is that strictly the transfer agent? Do you have any idea how that happens, how that works?
Well, I don't know, actually, okay. How that works. That would be up to the discretion, I believe, of the transfer agent to do that.
And that's probably going on this week, so I'm just wondering how they're doing that. RMA seemed to pay today, and we didn't really see much going on.
Well, I don't know that you would have been able to do that today.
Okay.
Because you would have already had to have made those. I think you would have to kind of know ahead of time what you were going to do that, and so I think today was the first day that they actually went below NAV.
Right. Okay.
So I believe that would be. You might find that in the future periods.
Okay.
But again, we've never crossed that bridge before either.
Right.
So, but,
that's how I led that off. This is uncharted territory for you guys. All right. You have any bullets left? You got any powder left so that you can take advantage of these opportunities that are now presenting themselves to you?
We do. We do have some cash on hand. We're just trying to be very selective in here.
Okay.
Trying to find the assets that do have at least, I guess, what we're looking for is an asset that has some sort of liquidity measure to it as well. Okay? Because right now, frankly, the best buys in some cases, but you're completely operating in a vacuum in terms of pricing and so forth. And so we're looking at trying to find some assets that may have liquidity structure around them so that we could kind of follow them a little bit closer. I mean, gosh, you can go in right now into a dealer and say, I'm looking for a triple B or a single A CDO, and you I would just, it could be a 20-point bid offer.
Just name your price?
Yeah, name your price. So it's that, and then the reason being is that the dealer, you know, may think it worth, you know, worth 80, but he may not even show you a 40 bid if you had the same CUSIP.
Right.
Simply because he has no capacity to bid.
Right.
He is overloaded in the ABX so much or has so much credit exposure due to, you know, trading other items that he simply has no way of adding that item. So it is a very difficult market.
Okay.
We are trying to be very selective here and there. And, you know, as well, those of you who have some venue into the open-end fund can see that we have been able to take advantage of this and produce a little more on the income side than we did last year. And that is, in fact, bearing out in the closed-end funds as well.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Burton Milner.
Hey, Jim. Burton here.
Yes.
Leverage, what percentage are you currently leveraged, and are you in danger of violating any of your leverage restrictions?
Well, that's a good question because that's a lot of what's happened here, forced selling due to margin calls. We have used a fairly low leverage with regard to closed-end funds. You can do up to 33% is allowable in a closed-end fund, and we've been somewhere in the you know mid to upper 20s. And we do, that gets recalculated by our lenders regularly, and I see that, and I think that we're still in good shape there. Not to mention we are sitting on, you know, enough cash that if we did have to do something there, we could cut that back.
So you can do that without having to sell assets?
Right.
Okay.
And it's, you know, the last measure, I think we had 5 to, you know, somewhere between 5, 6, or 7% of over collateralization above our, you know, the collateral requirement.
Okay. And I think you answered my other question, but let me ask it to you again. Do you have any assets out there where you cannot get a reasonable bid, and in that case, do you have to market to that bid to mark to market to do your NAV?
Yeah, that is. As a matter of fact, I will tell you that there is there's a lot of difficulty getting any bids or any marks in some of these situations these days.
Right.
Some of them are just literally completely indiscriminate, as in, I'm going to give you a number, but I do not even want to hear from you again.
And so does that affect your mark-to-market?
Yes, it does.
Okay. That's what I need. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Robert Shy.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, Robert.
What's the current default rate of the portfolio right now, bonds that are just non-performing?
Robert, I'm going to have to give you an estimate on that. We have generally been between, you know, a half of a percent of the portfolio up to, say, 2.5% of the portfolio at times. And we're probably somewhere in between that. Yeah, we've got two corporate bonds that aren't paying, and we've probably got, yeah, we're about 2%. About 2.25% of the portfolio is what we would call non-performing.
Now, as you've done your research in the past, you want to have, you know, $3 in assets for every dollar worth of loan you've got out. Are you going to be able to collect on these defaulted bonds?
I'm sorry, Robert. I'm not sure I understood your question there.
Well, when we originally started doing the high income fund years ago, you made the point that you said you look at these things like a bank does, and that you want to have three forms of repayment every time you make a loan. And I just want to make sure that you've got that these bonds that are in default, you know, are they going to be windfalls if we get to take the thing, or are we going to get paid off on them?
Well, not universally the case, Robert, and not always the case. Certainly that's a, you know, that's an ideal situation. We think that sometimes in our corporate situations, those have been the case. It's been a very good corporate market, and as a matter of fact, we've even invested or taken a position in a non-performing bond with the expectation that we will recover more than we're invested in. Oftentimes a company is worth more in Chapter 11 than out of Chapter 11, so that may be the case. Now, in the case of some of the subprime situations or some of the second lien bonds that we have, they simply haven't performed nearly as well as expected, and we probably won't collect. And as a matter of fact, in some of our situations over the years, we have not collected or recovered all of our money. That's also been the case in some of the corporates. So it's not a one-way answer. Some yes, some no. But by and large, we don't have any more non-performing assets than we've had, you know, at any one particular period in the past. Sometimes we've been, you know, had, you know, when everything is working, just get ready because something's getting, you know, will soon not be working. So it's in a high yield portfolio, we expect to deal with, you know, continually deal with, you know, troubled assets. And that's really the case. You know, that's the case now, but it has also been the case in the past. It's just that now we have a particularly volatile pricing environment, especially in the corporate, but in the structured area.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Lee Snipes.
Jim, do you know the percent of the volume that's coming from Morgan Keegan? And also, could you make a few comments on the intermediate bond fund and the implications from with the current market?
Lee, I don't know the volume. There may be someone at Morgan Keegan that tracks the volume, or the specialist that does the trading of those funds that tracks that volume. That's not something that I watch on a regular basis, or even that I'm made aware of on a regular basis. I don't know that answer. I know that we have had in the past a very wide following of these funds, and I know that we've continue to distribute information and take phone calls from a wide number of people and try to keep information available. So it's followed widely, but I do not know the exact volume numbers. The intermediate bond fund, just a couple of brief questions. Yeah, the spread widening on the products across the board is going to affect that fund too. That fund has been under pressure also. It's a higher credit quality fund, but anything, you know, even now we're seeing, you know, that the double A's in the structured product are being affected. So it's across the board in terms of spread widening. I don't know that we have any bond in that portfolio that's not performing. I think everything is rated, you know, triple B and higher for the most part. There may be a few bonds that have maybe slipped to double B, but I think every bond is performing there. But combined with higher interest rates over the course of the last quarter, 90 days or so, and the fairly dramatic widening in spread, that fund has been under pressure as well. Its earnings, though, have been steady and continue to stay on pace. It's about a 7% dividend on that fund, I think.
Mr. Snipes, do you have another question?
No. Well, one quick one, Jim. In subprime debt, 05 and 06 production, is that a fairly small portion of your subprime obligations?
Well, I think the most troublesome area, Lee, is the 06 and 07 production. And that is a relatively small portion of what we have. The newest collateral is the most troublesome collateral. The 04, 03, 04, and 05 does seem to be performing considerably better because there is some home price appreciation in those loans and some track record there in those loans. So they do seem to be performing better. Our, you know, the smallest exposure there is in the 07 production. We really sort of started cutting that back in 06 a lot, so we don't have much in the way of 06 paper either. Maybe 4 to 5 line items, I think.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Bob Elliott.
Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Couple of questions, Jim. As far as the RMH, FFA, and Y, are you aware of the short position that is on these stocks at this time?
I am not. One other broker within the system has mentioned that to me. But he said that there was a sizable short position, but I do not keep up with that, nor would I know about that specifically.
Follow-up question to that. If the short position is large, is there any way that Morgan Keegan can prevent other firms from borrowing that stock and shorting it?
Mm. an operational question that I won't know the answer to.
But again, that could be we could be hurting ourselves by lending out our stock and it be being used against us in that way. Okay.
Right.
Another question, follow-up question, is that on the open-end fund, the MKHIX, obviously, I would assume you've had some liquidations here and maybe more liquidations than you had new cash coming in. If that's the case, have you thought about possibly opening the fund back up to new investors?
Yes, it was something that was considered some time ago. It has been a consideration. It's been closed now for 5 years or thereabout. It's been you know, we've been restricting the cash flows in and out of that fund by its closure for some time, but it's a possibility. It would be under consideration. I think there are a number of factors that we have to consider in looking at that. And going back to your short position there, I think that the one thing that we've got to do to remember, you know, what we're doing with the short position is, I think if you're short the stock, you're also liable to dividend. So, you know, a continued good earnings there makes that and I think that, you know, down here the current yields are so high that it, you know, you sort of need the stock to go in the right direction if you're going to short it, because it costs you a lot. The negative carry is pretty heavy here. So I think, I don't really worry so much about the technicals in terms of who's shorting it or whatever. My job is to sort of focus on making sure I keep the portfolio producing the income and performing.
I understand. The final question, Jim, on the open-end fund, if by chance you're having to sell securities, is there some overlap as far as the investments that you've made on MKHIX and the other RMK funds?
Yes, there is lots of overlap.
Okay.
The funds are run, the open-end fund and then the four closed-end funds are very, very similar funds. They're all designed to be, in fact, the closed-end funds were designed to be the new outlet for money, or the new place to put money, you know, following the closure of that open-end fund.
Okay, to that point, if in fact you're having to sell any positions out of the MKHIX fund, could that be having to make you adjust your net asset value on your closed-end funds because you have to raise some cash?
Yes, it could.
Okay.
You know, I don't know that that's exactly been the case on anything we've done recently. We've been able to find fairly good liquidity recently in various sectors, but your point is, yes, it could. It's possible it could, yes.
Okay. Well, again, at some point, obviously, hopefully, we start to stabilize here and begin to go on the upward mode, and the short covering starts to occur. But keep up the good work and always keep us abreast of what's going on. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Bill Hytron. Please go ahead.
Jim, what's the discount to par in the open-end fund? In other words, what's the upside there?
You're referring to the weighted average price of the securities held in the fund?
Yes.
Bill, I used to know that number. It used to be somewhere in the 80s, you know, 80 cents on the dollar roughly. It would be lower now, but I do not know that number. It would have to easily be in the 70s now.
Yeah, moving a little quicker these days.
Yes, it is.
Keep up with. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Sam Chambers. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, Sam.
Hey, you spoke of volatility due to a few dealers. What would it take in this market to get more dealers out there trading in these securities to get a more liquid and a tighter market?
Well, Sam, that's I've got no idea for one, but I will tell you this: I don't know of any. There's no one that I talk to right now that is comfortable with where they stand.
Sure.
The credit gap is really what we're looking at is a deleveraging deleveraging effect of where you had people very willing to lend against any asset at any time, and now that's all reversing itself. And the most notable incident of that was the deleveraging at Bear Stearns.
Sure.
Okay. So with that going on, market-wide, if you will, there's just a lot more paper available than there is money to buy it. I remember very specifically the situation with high-yield corporate bonds back in the very late 80s, early 90s, I believe it was 1989, there was a law that changed the legality of owning below investment grade corporate bonds at certain institutions.
Yeah.
And it changed the whole market dynamic. And so you had literally every bond, you had, you know, just for instance, there was a $500 billion of market demand and $450 billion of bonds, and so every bond was at a premium or thereabout. And then, you know, with the change of that law, I believe it was FIREA, 1989, you know, $250 million of potential purchasers were, you know, out of the market. So every bond then went to a discount. Well, essentially, that's kind of what's going on now, is that you had lots of demand made available via leverage, and now as that leverage is coming off, you know, everything is having to reprice to a different level. And so we're sort of working our way through that. So it's really, you know, yes, there are some credit fundamentals. I won't discount that completely, but I will tell you this. Right now it's more of a liquidity and deleveraging effect than anything else.
Okay. And you say that the vast majority of this is probably hitting the structured products that you have that make up 45-50% of the portfolio.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Okay, so that having been said, of the structured products that you have in your portfolio, how much has the price changed on that 50% of your portfolio? For example, where were they prior to, you know, June when Bear Stearns started to unwind, to where they are right now? I mean, how much have they dropped in value, basically? I'm just trying to get an idea of how much these structured products have come under pressure.
And I'll tell you this, it's a tough number to get a handle on, because I don't, you know, all of that I don't see on an everyday basis, but it's got to be 25-30%.
Okay, all right.
If not more.
Okay. Now, if the pendulum swung too far, and I'm almost finished here, but if the pendulum swung too far in the direction of these things going down, and, you know, we have some event take place, like somebody's closing out a year, or some big money, you know, investor comes in and says, look, there's value here, and some shorts start to cover, that should have a pretty darn dramatic effect on the NAVs coming back up, I would imagine, just the same as they did going down. And I mean, that sounds like a stupid question, but tell me I'm wrong. Or I'm right.
Well, you know, it's in this particular market, I will be very hesitant to say this is what I expect to happen, or this is what's going to happen,
and that
sort of thing. But you've got an awful lot of excess inventory right now.
Okay.
Okay. That's got to get worked off,
sure.
And then you can see things begin to recover a bit.
Okay.
I think that one of the elements that has created a lot of excess inventory, if you will, or a lot of excess credit risk is the ABX index.
Right.
Okay. The 061 series, the 062 series, and the 071 series, and now soon to be the 072 series, basically allow a format for any sort of investor or any sort of fund to express a bearish opinion of U.S. housing or the U.S. economy. So, whereas the original intent was, it, you know, CDO ramp-ups, ramp-ups of CDOs, typical cash bond buyers and dealers who position big warehouses or pools of loans to securitize would use this index as a hedging mechanism. It is now being used very broadly, I believe, by other participants than bond fund managers or CDO managers or even broker dealers. So what happens is you pick a broker, a big dealer A, which would be a very recognizable wirehouse name, as he is being asked to sell protection, that is someone going short the ABX, to someone who doesn't have any exposure at all to bonds, nor has any cash bond holdings,
right,
nor manages any fixed income assets. So that sort of amplifies the volume on the downside. And so I believe that it is my opinion that the broker-dealer community, the very large dealer community, are way over the levels of risk that they want to be in, because now, just for instance, a macro equity fund is now shorting the ABX. So there's no natural buyer on the other side of that, or no natural buyer of that risk. And so the dealer is taking that. And so then when you go back to the dealer and say, you know, how about a bid on my bond? They go, look, we got all we can take, and we're loaded on the ABX.
I got you. So speculation in that market, like it does in a lot of other, you know, even commodity-type markets, is driving, is affecting the ultimate price. Last quick question.
And drying up a lot of liquidity.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you take a dealer that's now short, you know, having to accommodate the short side of funds that usually don't even have a long side on the bond, you know. So if you're a bond investor, for instance, you may go long a cash bond, an actual bond with a CUSIP and a coupon and a maturity. You may go long that, but say I want to hedge it by shorting the ABX.
Sure.
You know, that's an even trade.
Right.
But if you're looking at that, an equity hedge fund or a macro currency fund or what have you that simply wants to express a short position, then there's no natural hedge to that, no natural layoff of that risk. So it just amplifies the amount of liquidity required, and hence has amplified the downward volatility on all credit-related structures.
That's very helpful. And your duration, just quickly, on the high-income funds across the board, average duration?
You know, it hasn't changed much. It'd be, you know, in the 4 to 5 range, you know, somewhere between, you know, 3.5 to 5.5 type duration. But frankly, in terms of duration, doesn't have a thing in the world to do with it right now.
I understand. Jim, thanks so much for your accessibility. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Gary Williams.
Jim, I know that with current bids, it's hard to get a complete handle on NAV, but over a long period of time, by prospectus, if the NAV was at a significant discount to the trading price, would you have the option to liquidate the fund over time and return those assets at NAV on the closed-end funds?
If the price were below NAV, right?
Well, I'm talking about just, you know, over a period of time, if the NAV continued to be significantly below the share price and you didn't see any recovery in that in the future, would you have that option to liquidate at NAV and return the assets to shareholders?
I don't know that answer. I don't know that. I don't know that you would want to do that. If it were the other way around, if the NAV were above the share price, you might want to do that. You see, because then you would actually help the share price by, you know, returning more assets than it's priced at. So,
I'm sorry, that's what I meant. I meant that if the share price continued significantly at a discount to NAV over a period of time.
You know, that conceptually would make some sense, but I don't know that I'm that would be new territory for me. I'm not familiar with that. I think the first thing you'd want to do would be activate, you know, your share dividend reinvest and your share repurchases first.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Alan Gottlieb.
Yeah. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Alan.
How are you? What percent of the closed-end portfolios, as they are today, have you purchased in the last month? Have you done much purchasing, any purchasing? Is it the same portfolio today as a month ago?
Some. We've done some new purchasing there, but it's not going to be that much. No, it's, you know, I would say 5 to 10% maybe.
Okay. And can you give us an example of the yield to maturities in terms to maturity on the issues you have added in the last 30 days?
Well, Alan, I don't know that I can. I don't have that in front of me.
Are you buying at 14% yields to maturity, or are you buying at 30% yields to maturity?
More like 14 to 18.
Okay.
The reason being, as I mentioned earlier, that the very highest yields that are out there are simply so illiquid right now, I'm afraid to venture into that too much, to let it, you know, at least find a bottom there and start working from there. But there's so much available, you know, well beyond 12%, but inside of 20% that has some, you know, where I used to have to buy single B bonds a year and a half ago, you can get the same yield on triple B or even single A now. So it's way, you know, pushed way back there. So instead of going all the way down, we're sort of, you know, moving a little further up the credit structure there.
Those items that were in the Bear Stearns hedge funds, did you bid on any of that paper?
I did not.
Okay.
Most of those were not, most of those were well further up the credit stack than we participate. Most of the bonds that we saw on the list from Bear Stearns were AAA and AA, CDO, and subprime mortgage-backed issues. And the question becomes, why did that create so much volatility? It's because they were levered so much. You know, with, you know, if you add, you know, 8 to 12 times leverage and you move a bond 1 point, then that's more like 12, right? So the earthquake that it created was due to the leverage, not necessarily just the movement in the bonds.
I appreciate it. I thank you for your time, Jim.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Gary Aday.
Jim, my question is somewhat similar to a couple previous ones, but perhaps a bit more pointed. As we kind of help navigate our customers through this, you know, it's one thing to say, well, it's a market cycle and assets are being marked down, the cash flow's continuing, this is just something we got to sort of ride through, we're long term. To me, it becomes another thing when you, again, look at the default risk. And I know you had mentioned earlier that 2 to 2.5% of the portfolio was non-performing. I guess what I've read is there's much more exposure to floating rate product, very high default rates being experienced of, you know, upwards of 10%, and that may again be on the recent origination, but that's what concerns me more is if this is a market cycle, we can ride this out, we're long term, you know, that's fine. If there's really a default risk exposure that's ahead of us, you know, then to me, I guess that's a little bit more troubling as I try to talk people through this and, you know, make decisions about staying in or buying now or what to do. So I guess I wanted to ask you specifically about what I've read about some of these 10% default rates. Are we exposed in that? And again, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but are we exposed to the floating rate area? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not sure certainly I can't see, you know, beyond the end of my nose for the most part, but in what's going on in the marketplace, I do believe, yes, that there are some elevated default risks in certainly some of the subprime areas and the mortgage areas, and we have experienced that, and we've got some assets that have just taken, you know, dramatic markdowns, but we also have assets that are performing, you know, perfectly well that have also taken markdowns that I think, you know, are way overdone in terms of where they should pay and what they should be worth. So it's not an answer that you can, you know, say it's unilaterally this way or the other. It's also, if I could sort of harken back to the cycle that occurred in corporates in 1999, 2000, 01, and 02, where corporate bonds experienced a very high default rate in the 2001-02 time frame, and then probably bottomed, I guess, in 03 and began to come back. The entire asset class of below investment grade corporate bonds was very depressed, but not all of them defaulted. So we have the same sort of thing working here, is that the entire asset class of mortgages are very depressed, but certainly we won't have, you know, not all of them will default. And so I think the volatility is probably, you know, amplified to that effect. In our corporate holdings back in the 2001, 2003 time frame, we did experience some defaults. We had some bonds that didn't pay and we had to work out of over time. And that'll be the case, here as well. But I don't know that it's anything beyond the scope of what you know would be expected in a normal market cycle.
Where are we
to an asset class?
Where are we, Jim, on the floating rate subprime holdings? Have you been, you know, is that a significant portion of this 55% or the 15 to 20% subprime? Is it, you know, is that exposed to floating rate or is it fixed?
Most of it's floating.
Okay.
I don't think that there's very little in the way of subprime mortgages, or even very little in the way of mortgages any sort, originated in the last 3 or 4 years that were fixed rate mortgages. Most are all floating. You know, most are ARM product, either 2.28 or 3.27 floating rate. But on the other side of that, our bonds are floating rate as well. The bonds against them in the structure are also floating rate as well. So, you know, rates higher, that should produce higher cash flows, of course, and as long as you're getting paid. So that also produces a period about 24 to 36 months in that usually accelerates the prepayments as these loans come up for to reset. You know, any borrower that is capable of getting a refinance will do so, and it tends to, you know, pay off the pool much faster. So you kind of want fast prepayments in here. It does help delever the pool a bit.
Well, Jim, I appreciate you taking the time to visit with us. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Jim Darlington.
Hi, Jim. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, a couple questions. One, and let me just complimentary here, but you mentioned something just on the last call about prepayments. If the bonds that you own are, you know, were valued at 80 and now they're valued at, you know, 50 or whatever they're valued at, but then they prepay, they would typically prepay, you know, 100% of what they owe, right?
Yeah, if you get a prepayment, it comes in at 100 cents on the dollar.
Right, so all of a sudden that's going to help the NAV because you've got to revalue that security at now not 50 cents, but 80 or 100, whatever you bought it at, right?
Well, no, not specifically, because typically you get what's going on in the marketplace now is you will get some prepayments that will come in at 100 cents on the dollar, but the value on the remaining piece will usually suffer to some degree. It's kind of the ex-dividend effect, if you will. You know, if you get a big payment in at 100 cents on the dollar, then the remaining tail is sort of like, well, I don't know if I'm going to get all that money, so a big chunk just went away at par. Maybe I better discount the remaining tail a bit. So it doesn't have – in the past, Jim, yes, you're right. It created a big push, but now the credit market is so illiquid and so skeptical of actual payments following through that you don't get much push behind that big prepay cycle.
But I guess my question then.
So the best thing that happens then is you get the cash and then you go back and, you know, reinvest that cash under, you know, the dire circumstances we're in, and you should have a better yield going forward. So, you know, any cash coming in right now is good news.
Yeah, I guess my reasoning in this is, you know, if you're 40 to 50% was, you know, marked down or you can't really get good bids on them, then all of a sudden they're prepaid, or, you know, if you said it's really irrelevant what your duration is, well, if it's only 4 or 5 years and you see most of that money coming back, then shouldn't the NAV go up if you get most of that money back? Because, you know, these aren't defaulting.
Well, you know, you can't say what will happen in 4 or 5 years, but yes, I mean, theoretically, as you say, then the bond should migrate toward a more reasonable price. But it's impossible to say what's going to happen that far out, and certainly there will be some that will not. So, I mean, it's impossible to say that, you know, which ones will or which ones will not pay off. But I do believe that, you know, a lot of the depression in the pricing right now is really driven by the liquidity and the lack of any credit availability to take positions in the marketplace. You know, we went through a period of time after September the 11th of 2001 where anything related to aircraft just fell into a complete black hole. Totally, you know, went no bid. You know, the airline industry sort of shut down. And that, you know, we've talked about on calls before how that, you know, particular sector has done very well for us. Now, has it recovered all the way back to 100 cents on the dollar? No, it hasn't, but it's certainly gotten back up into the 80s and 90s, you know, from being in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
So I do expect some recovery. I don't know that you can expect full recovery.
Okay.
Just to be realistic.
Right. Well, right now, the yield, you know, is in the high 13s or 14s. So is it realistic to say that, you know, as you get this cash back, you're going to be able to reinvest it and get that same type of yield?
Well, you know, any cash we get right now, it's not very hard to replace that sort of yield.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other question is this, and I know you don't really have a control of this. My concern is right here, you know, if you bought your fund a year or two ago, you reinvested dividends, you might have the same value as you did a year, you know, as your original investment, but your investment, so therefore you got an unrealized gain, or unrealized loss, I mean, in these funds. And so as the end of the year approaches and you have equity funds distributing capital gains and you need something to offset it, do you see more pressure on your funds towards the end of the year because of people taking losses? And if that's the case, then that short squeeze, those people really have a market there that they could, you know, buy themselves, you know, back in or buy their way back out because they're people selling because of the, you know, taking losses. Now, I mean, you understand my reasoning?
Well, I do. I can follow it to some degree, but frankly, that's the first time I've thought of it. You just introduced a scenario there that I had not considered nor thought about, and your expectation of that, or your, you know, handicapping of that sort of scenario would be as good as mine.
Okay.
I don't know that that would be. I can't comment one way or the other on that one.
Right, but it's not. It wouldn't affect the NAV. It would just affect, I guess, whether it's selling a discount or a premium.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, thanks for your help. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from Chuck Collins.
Hey, Jim. You said on the high yield funds, your non-performings have been in a band as high as about 2.5%, and we're about 2.25% right now. Is there any way to get a feel for where you may see this thing max out at in the environment right now? Are we still trying to catch a knife? And if so, at what point do you see the non-performance becoming a real big problem for the portfolios with your leverage?
Well, to back up, the leverage is impacted by the, you know, the valuation of the collateral. You know, so that, you know, whether it's, you know, performing or non-performing, the lender doesn't care. It's just a matter of where it's, you know, how much collateral they have supporting the loan. So we'll leave that. That shouldn't be a big impact there. But I think that in the context of non-performing, it certainly would feel to me like that, you know, we've got more wood to chop there going forward. However, the ability to replace any non-performing asset right now is so easily done. With regard to replacing any yield, it's just, you know, you just name your levels for the most part. So I think that may be a mitigating factor there, that we may be able to, you know, if we've got, you know, any sort of asset that we sell right now that we can replace with a higher yield no matter what, because we're just so much available. So I'm not, it'd be hard for me to suggest one way or the other on that. I don't see that as a problem right now. Not to say that it couldn't be a problem in the future, but I don't see that right now.
Okay, so if we're in this thing for the long haul and we keep averaging down in here, then with these bids that are almost non-existent, barring any situation that gets much worse than where we are right now, you know, as these things do mature, we should be sitting fine, shouldn't we?
You know, I got to be careful here because I don't want to, you know, I'm not on the call to try to sell anybody anything or try to take a position one way or the other. I'll tell you this, that my objective from the very beginning was to create a product that had a good monthly cash flow, that came from a diverse set of, base of assets, from as wide a variety of assets as I could find, that produced a monthly dividend back to your customer. That was my objective, and, you know, I'm still on that objective. So that's what we're working to do. And I think that, you know, you go through times when stocks that they're paying a good dividend and the stock goes up and the stock goes down. But if the company continues to pay the good dividend and grow the earnings, then it should come back in value some. It may be out of favor, but we are certainly out of favor now. But I think that our ability to continue on that dividend path to generate cash flow for spending money, if you will, they've never been advertised nor sold nor presented as a growth stock. That's not the story, but its purpose is to generate monthly dividends, and it's to that extent it is on course.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Thank you. Your next question is coming from David Heidrick.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
David.
Quick couple of questions for you. Have you noticed recently, you've mentioned the ABX quite a few times during the call, have you noticed a tighter correlation with the ABX in your funds over the past month versus over the past 18 or so?
David, I was going to say yeah, possibly. And I was just trying to think that through a second. Why would it be more correlated? I think to the extent that we're correlated is to the, let me go back for a second. Correlation would follow where everything else is trading, and the market makers in general who are so overburdened now with the ABX, that would follow through that they're going to have lower and less aggressive or less interesting bids for other assets. We had an 04, 05, 06 time frame where the CDO machine was ramping every month, many different bonds. There was lots of demand for paper, lots of lots of liquidity, and without that buyer in the marketplace, things that were liquid or not liquid, things that were easily traded or not easily traded, and to that extent, the very heavy inventory of ABX that we mentioned earlier, I think, has increased the correlation to some degree on all of our other asset classes. Like I said, it's spread even now to corporate high-yield bonds to some degree. So you've asked a question that I don't know the answer to exactly, but I think yes. And my thinking that through is that's my thought process on that, David, is that it is more correlated because the more downside volatility we see there, the more pressure we see at the dealer level as well.
But your overall exposure to that sector has not increased, though.
No.
Even though the correlation may have.
Correct.
And then also kind of a follow-up question on that is the macro, you'd mentioned, macro funds, et cetera, shorting the ABX, taking a position, on housing and subprime. If people shorted your fund, they'd have at this point, a 13 to 14% dividend that they've got to cover. When the people short the ABX, is there a big coupon that they've got to cover as well?
Yes. That is a huge negative carry. I don't want to go into it on this call, but it is the ABX is its points up front, meaning that if you short or buy protection, let me just put it this way, the ABX is an index where, if you essentially want to say you want to short it, that means you're buying protection against losses. And now, say the 071 triple B minuses are trading around the mid-40s. That means you have to put up 55 cents on the dollar up front is your initial premium to buy protection, and then you have a coupon on a monthly basis thereafter, which is something like 340 or 380 basis points.
Yeah, 389.
389 on the very discounted dollar price. So the current yield is, more like 9 or 10%, plus you've put up 55 points up front. So the negative carry is huge on that. It needs to go down, or that trade doesn't work very well.
There's no point that those funds would have more of an incentive to cover that position with the coupon and stuff like they would maybe with yours.
I think there would be more incentive that if it were to stall and not go down further, I think they would want to cover it pretty quick. Things sort of find a value and begin to move back the other way. You get that short squeeze could be quick, because remember, you're already out 50 or more cents on the dollar, you know, that you had to put up. So the guy that has sold you the risk, or that guy has, I'm sorry, the guy who has accepted the risk of default, has the 50 cents on the dollar plus the coupon. And he can invest that anyhow, any way he would like, you know, which would be usually, because he only has to deliver if a bond actually doesn't pay in that pool. And those are triple B minuses, and it's going to be, it'll be 12 to 18 months, you know, even in the worst case, before one of those bonds doesn't pay. So, it you know, it's an index that's technically driven now, not necessarily fundamentally driven. I tell you what, operator, if we could take maybe one more here and sort of wrap up here. We've gone about, you know, an hour or so on Q&A. Let's see if we can get one more question in.
Your final question, sir, is coming from Stephen Rosen.
Well, well, well. I couldn't have cut it off one earlier.
Jim, come on. I'm not worth that kind of intro. Three quick ones here. Are you long any private equity sponsored bonds or loans, any of these LBO deals of recent vintage? And I mean outside of a CLO that you own directly.
We are long some 144A or private equity, yes.
Okay. Is it substantial, and is that anything we need to be majorly concerned about?
It's not. It's part of our 10 to 11% allocation in commons. It's a relatively small position there, and it's, you know, bonds, you know, companies that have come out with a 144A offering that we've been able to participate in, that we expect, you know, on an IPO to either roll that into the new stock or sell into that particular new that IPO.
Okay. Second one, on the CDO world, are you seeing sponsors of CDOs come out and try to take advantage of this market dislocation by buying back the tranches in order to capture the collateral, in effect, kind of buy their own deal back at a discount? Is that starting to happen yet?
I haven't seen that. I have begun to I think that there are some probes out there looking for that.
Okay. And the last question, if you covered this earlier, just we'll end it here. Your line of credit on the closed-end funds, when does the line of credit expire? And is there any risk to being able to extend that line of credit, or those lines of credit?
I don't know the answer to those. Those are usually one-year annual renewable lines of credit through Bank of New York and Citigroup. They are monitored on a weekly basis for collateral coverage, and we have not had any issues there at this point. We don't have any. We've not even, you know, they've checked our subprime cover, subprime exposure that's part of the collateral. Anything that they don't like in the collateral pool, they can sort of kick out. But since we are, you know, essentially they have access to the entire portfolio, so they have, you know, 3.5 to 1 coverage of the collateral, so that of the loan. So they're really not very eager for us not to borrow the money. It's not as if, you know, you're getting, you know, in a hedge fund, you put down 10 cents on the dollar and borrow 90. You know, we're putting down 75 cents on the dollar or more and borrowing 25 cents on the dollar.
Are you aware of any closed-end funds that haven't had credit lines renewed?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Good.
Very often, Stephen, a closed-end fund uses a preferred as their means of leverage. And so, you know, we're using a little bit different, taking a little bit different tack there and using the credit lines, you know, with the anticipation, you know, provides us a little more volatility and we maybe can borrow the money a little cheaper. But, and that I believe has been the case. We have certainly been able to borrow the money cheaper over time. But I don't know if any, to answer your question, I don't know of anyone who's had any problem with credit lines, because remember, a closed-end fund simply isn't levered nearly the way a hedge fund would be. It's not the same category at all.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. I know that we had an awful lot of people here on the phone and a lot of people joining us here, and I think we probably could go on for quite some time, but we've got to kind of sort of rejoin the workday here. Thank you for joining us for the call. We are trying to respond as quickly and as promptly as we can to any of your calls, and we're going to have some things out on the some published comments out that'll be available, and we'll try to get those out to you probably tomorrow. Thank you very much, and we will. All I can do too is tell you that we're going to be about our work and try to deliver the numbers as best we possibly can, and I hope for a better market conditions soon. Thank you.
And this concludes today's Morgan Asset Management conference call. You may now disconnect your lines and have a pleasant evening.